Thank you for coming, everybody. So this talk will be in English. Unless everybody understands Dutch, I can also do it in Dutch, but okay, English done. All right, the slides will be in Dutch. So for those who don't speak English too well, you can follow in Dutch on the slides. So what I want to talk about today is how you can help build a plant-based or a vegan future. I want you to do more than just eat vegan donuts and use vegan shampoo. I want you to like get active. So that's what this is going to be about. So I'm going to tell you about the problem, which is a huge, incredible, horrible problem. Then about where we are today, and then about what you can do. So just briefly about me, I work for, or I'm a co-founder of ProVeg International, which is the biggest vegan organization in the world. We have 200 people in 10 countries. I also founded, co-founded EVA, which is now ProVeg Belgium, the Belgium chapter of ProVeg. I have my own blog, Vegan Strategist, and I wrote just one book, not all these books. This is just one book in different languages. I have some copies with me in Dutch and in French for those who want. And I live in the Flemish Ardennes. Some of you may know the town of René, close to there. And we have a little sanctuary, which my girlfriend runs. We rescue a lot of chickens. And you can also stay in this little house. It's a bread and breakfast if you want to look it up, featheryforest.be. So then you stay amidst the trees and amidst the animals in a vegan environment. So the problem that we're facing is just gigantic, and it's at the same time a beautiful problem, because if you tackle it, you tackle so many different issues at the same time, right? You tackle environmental things, you tackle health issues, and especially you tackle animal welfare issues. I just mentioned these very briefly in terms of sustainability, in terms of the environment. Every major environmental problem is caused by the meat industry or by animal agriculture in part, right? Animal agriculture is in the top three causes of every major environmental problem, be it climate change, rainforest destruction, land use, etc. It's also, I'm going to go very fast because I'm assuming most of you know these things. It's also very resource intensive, and most of you may know that if you have a certain amount of plant-based products, grain for instance, or soy, you can feed more people if you give that food to the people directly than if you are going to give it to a cow and then eat the cow. That's because, well, this is a detour, this is inefficient. The cow will use most of this plant-based food for her own energy and movement, etc. And only a small part will be converted into meat that you can eat. And this is especially problematic because we are using a tremendous amount of land also for the production of this food. If you look at all the land that we use for the production of animal foods for people, that is equivalent to the surface of the continents of South America and Africa together. So these continents together, that's equivalent to the surface that we use for to produce animal food. That's incredible. We can do a lot of other stuff with that land if we wouldn't have to use it for animal agriculture. The second one is health. There's cancer, heart disease, diabetes, overweight, all these serial killers in Western countries. They are, the risk of those increases with the amount of animal products that you eat. We can't say that animal products are toxic or that you can't have them in no degree for health, but certainly the degree to which we eat them in Western countries is problematic. And there's other things, like we know that a lot of health costs are caused by animal agriculture. So there's been studies that say that, for instance, in Germany, 30% of all the health costs that we have to spend on people are caused by the overconsumption of animal products. Antibiotics resistance could be one of the big problems in the future. You know, like we are creating strains of bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics. That could be become a tremendous problem that most of us are not yet talking about. So a lot of health problems, also including, of course, pandemics, which is kind of like a new problem for many people. The risk of pandemics increases with intensive agriculture, right? So for intensive agriculture, we're going to like encroach on a lot of natural land, and we come into contact with new creatures and new viruses, new organisms. And also in these big structures, these big hangars full of animals, viruses have a lot of chance to mutate and to become more dangerous. And then thirdly, the animal problem itself, and this is what has always most concerned me and what moves me most. I just want to give you an idea of how big this problem is. And I repeat these things just because I want to make you enthusiastic to get into this further in your career, in your life, whatever. I just want to illustrate the size of the problem. So we've had very briefly sustainability, we've had health, and now we have animals. We are 8 billion people in the world, right? This is the number of farmed animal mammals that are present at any moment in the world. That's 5.5 billion sheep, pigs, goats, rabbits, and cattle, cows, right? 5.5 billion at every moment you can find in the world. Which animals are missing here? Yes, several categories are missing. So let's see what happens if I add the chickens. If I add the chickens, we get 34 billion animals. These are the chickens that we breed for meat and these for eggs. And then the whole circle from the previous slide is now just this pie, right? What else is missing? You already said fish are missing. So what if we add farmed fish? Then we get to this picture. So these are all farmed fish, and this is the rest of the animals. And then another way to put this is the number of animals. This is the number of animals that are present in the world at any moment. This is the number of animals that we slaughter per year. And this is then including wild fish. And then we get to a very, very rough estimation of 1,600 billion animals. And that is, to just give you a sense of scale, that is every year more animals than there have ever people lived in history. Every year, we kill more animals than the total number of people who ever lived. That is, to me, that's a staggering statistic. So if you want to get another idea of how many that is, 75 billion land animals without fish a year, 200 million a day. In the time I'll be talking here, we will have killed 8 million animals. And the problem with these animals, it's not just the fact that we have to kill them, but of course that they're treated very badly. If you look at the very structural problem, it's something like this. We have to get the price right, because the consumer wants to buy cheap meat and the producer wants to sell it at a reasonable price. And therefore, we have to make sure that the lives of these animals are as short as possible, because every day they live longer, they will cost more in terms of electricity, energy, food, etc. Right? So what have we done? We have bred animals through breeding, manipulation, whatever. We have created creatures that grow very fast. And this is the this is how the animals look at slaughter weight throughout the decennia. Right? And you can see that, well, now we have animals that we are killing after 6 weeks. After 6 weeks, they are big enough. 6 weeks, they have a very big body, an adult body, but they're not adults, they're still chicks. If you would compare it to humans, you would compare it to an 8-year-old boy who is a bodybuilder. Something like that. That is what we have bred. That's like the Frankenstein creatures that we have bred. And of course, there's a lot of consequences to this kind of breeding, to creating these animals, a lot of health issues. For instance, for chickens, you can see a host of problems, a host of causes of suffering for these creatures that live. Actually, you have to say that live, fortunately, very short lives. Fortunately, because their lives are horrible, so you could say like the briefer they are, the better, unfortunately. So where are we? Some hope. I think the biggest hope I can see is in the numbers that we meet or that we see sometimes in studies among young people. So this is a BBC poll, and it said that 8% of children between 5 and 16 is vegan, 13% is vegetarian, and even more want to be vegan or vegetarian. So that is almost 50% of kids in this category who are or want to be vegan or vegetarian. which is good news, I think. We are seeing also more and more government efforts to speed up this plant-based transition. Government is finally starting to get it, right? There's still a big part of the population that's not getting it, but governments are finally starting to get it. And thirdly, after consumers and government, we have also the whole industry, which is coming up, obviously, as you know, with better and better products, better and better technologies, like here Impossible Foods, or this is Redefined Meat, an Israeli company that is 3D printing meat. Of course, cell-based technology. So we take a cell from an animal and we try to multiplicate it and get meat, reproduce meat, real meat from animal cells that way. This is still a while off. People estimate, the latest estimations are that by the time we will get like a viable product that's competitive in terms of price, will take another 10 years probably. Right? But we may see the first products on the market at a high price in maybe next year, maybe the year after, right? So it's coming closer. And thirdly, fermentation is another very promising technique where we change the function of proteins through microorganisms, through bacteria, where we can, for instance, create casein or whey, which are the protein of milk and cheese. We can recreate them like really very similarly, and so create the perfect cheese and the perfect milk without use of animals. We are also seeing changes in the restaurant industry. Maybe some of you have seen this. I think this is very important to do. In Austria, in Burger King, they were asking people who were ordering their burgers, they were asking, do you want a normal one or a meat one, right? So that is turning the norms around. It's incredibly important. It's showing people more and more that meat is not or should not be the normal thing, right? This is very inspiring, I think, and you can imagine also that when one party, one company, one restaurant chain does it, it becomes easier for the next one and for the next one and for the next one. So very important. Another great example within retail is, I think, what Lidl has done. I mean, of course, you can imagine that supermarkets are very happy to sell more and more plant-based, especially if that doesn't bite into their meat sales. Right? And that's what is still happening. A lot of supermarkets are selling more and more plant-based, but they're not selling less meat. And of course, that doesn't have much impact for animals or for the environment or whatever. So Lidl has been the first supermarket saying, we're also going to do something about our meat offering. We're going to like offer less meat products and we're going to try to sell less of it. So spectacular, the first one in the world to do this, and hopefully there will be more to follow. And another piece of good news is the fact that the difference in price between animal products and plant-based products is getting smaller. It's still a lot. I mean, if you get one of those artisanally created vegan cheeses here, you will pay probably for a camembert 10 times as much as for an animal camembert. Yeah? So that's not feasible for most people. There is still bad stuff happening. Also, this is or was a campaign financed by the European community with European subsidies, Become a Beefetarian. This is obviously a campaign from the meat industry, and Europe supports that still. There are negotiations about whether they should still continue to do that. Belgium has signed a letter to please continue subsidizing the meat advertisements. And of course, you know, I mean, I think you are quite aware and you have your eyes open, but most people still have these blindfolds on. We still are seeing that consumption of meat and animal products is increasing worldwide. It is slowing down here in Western countries, but worldwide it is still increasing. And if you look at the total market share of plant-based substitutes compared to meat or compared to the originals, then you see that it's only 0.7%. Less than 1% of the meat market is plant-based. So we have so much work to do still. Don't think that it's gonna happen just by itself. So there's the question, how can you contribute? And maybe you have been asked the question, if you do something for for animals or for discourse, maybe you've been asked the question, why do you work for animals? Why do you give donations to animal causes? Why there's so much human suffering in the world? Have you had that question by family or somebody who like is trying to second guess what you do and is trying to relativize the support you give animals and trying to prioritize other causes? There are, of course, so many wonderful and important causes to work for, but I just want to tell you very briefly why it is important and very worthwhile to work for animals. And I'm just gonna borrow from a movement that you may have heard of, effective altruism. Effective altruism is about making the world a better place, but doing it as effectively as possible. And we have within effective altruism three criteria to choose a cause and to say that a cause is important. One is scale, so how many beings are afflicted by the problem in terms of quantity and also in terms of quality, so how bad is the suffering. And I think you know, I think you realize with the numbers that I told you, that with animals the scale is gigantic. It is bigger than any other problem that we know with humans, literally, I think. I mean, because the numbers are so huge and literally beings are miserable or can be miserable for their entire lives. It's not like a disease with humans that afflicts you part of the time, maybe. It's entire misery the entire life. Secondly, verwaarlozing is neglect, which means how many resources are already going to that problem. Are people already investing a lot of money and time and other resources on it? And here we can see in the case of animals that actually that is quite small. To give you an illustration, the total budget of an organization like UNICEF, which is to a large part publicly sponsored with donations, the total yearly budget of UNICEF, helping children, is $6 billion a year, $6 billion. Do you know what the total budget of all the organizations together working for farmed animals is? So UNICEF, $6 billion. All organizations worldwide working for farmed animals, 100 million at most, right? So just to show how neglected that is. In the United States, if you study charitable giving by people, it's 0.015% of the donations that goes to farmed animals. 0.015% that goes to the 10 billion animals that are killed there every year. So very neglected. So if somebody asks you, why do you do something for animals? Why do you donate to animals? You can say, because nobody else is doing it. And thirdly, importantly, it's solvable. This problem is solvable. It is, of course, a huge task, but it's elegant. The solution is quite elegant. If we can convince all these people, 8 billion people, to eat differently, we will have eliminated 99% of human-caused animal suffering. So, scale, neglect, and solvability. Three reasons why you shouldn't feel embarrassed to prioritize animals. So what can you do? First of all, there's your consumption. I mean, I want to ask you, and most of you, I guess, already do that, to eat as plant-based as possible. You could say to be vegan, but as vegan as you can, let's say. And being vegan is one of the most, if not the most, impactful things a consumer, a citizen can do. For animals, obviously also for the environment. If politicians and other people try to do something for the environment related to food, they will also come up with this, local food. Have you been confronted with the idea of local food? Like, local food is not unimportant and it plays a role, and I don't want to bash it, but it is of significantly small importance compared to switching to plant-based. If you look at this graph, this is the life cycle analysis in terms of CO2 emissions of different products, like in which different phases of the lifetime of a product, how much CO2 emissions are there in these different phases. And you see here, the transportation part is in red. Can you see the emissions caused by transportation in this graph? So for instance, for beef, it's right here. That is the emissions caused by transportation. So it doesn't do all that much. It might be important socially, etc., But compared to like switching to plant-based, of course, you're going to have a lot more impact doing that. But why are so many people emphasizing this local thing? Because it's very uncontroversial. Nobody is against that. No politician, no farmer, no supermarket is going to be against local, right? So that's why this is getting a lot of importance. So if your community, your company or whatever is saying, oh, we're doing our best for the environment, we're going as local as possible, then please challenge them and tell them that they should add something else to it. Okay, so this change in diet, you can go cold turkey or you can do it at a snail's pace, I don't care. If you haven't changed towards eating plant-based, do it some way. I think one of the best ways is to to follow a campaign like that, like the Veggie Challenge, there's other ones like Veganuary, right? And you can also, if you are already vegan, this is also the way to try to influence other people to go vegan. If they are willing, you can tell them, like, try this. Do the Veggie Challenge, do Veganuary, try it for 30 days, no commitment for what you do afterwards, just give it a try and support them while they do it, and they can be supported with the newsletters, etc. that they get. I think this is one of the best ways to get into it, because people are so afraid of missing whatever they like forever. They think like, okay, oh my God, I love meat so much, and they think that they're gonna miss it forever if they stop eating it. But of course, that's not true. I mean, those of you who are vegan know that after a while, it's just natural and you don't miss it anymore. So you just have to get beyond those first few months to just get over that missing. That's what this is about. Also, if you are not vegan yourself, or when you communicate to other people, don't think in terms of black and white. Okay, it's not vegan or not vegan. It's not like being pregnant or not pregnant, right? It's not being so vegan that you don't watch Kevin Bacon movies, right? And some people don't like when I say that, but it's not about perfection. And this perfection, this desire for perfection, this desire for people to do it perfect may actually harm us and may harm animals. Because when you ask for perfection, a lot of people just will not follow. So appreciate a concept like being 95% vegan. Like if people say, I can't give up cheese, but I want to change, but I can't give up cheese. Maybe just tell them, like, just keep eating cheese and do all the rest, right? Switch all your products to plant-based and keep eating cheese when you want. Or keep going to your grandmother and eat that whatever she serves 3 times a year or at Christmas. I don't mind. You're doing 95 or 98% of the work. That's very important. Don't get hung up on the final couple of percentages. So there's a lot of ways to switch. There's a lot of ways to make an impact without being perfect. You can become vegetarian, or you can stop eating this or that animal, or you can be vegan in the week and on the weekend or whatever. Just one thing I want to warn about, one thing is not a good step, and that's people switching from red to white meat. Never encourage that. And if your company or whatever is encouraging people to do that, to switch from red to white, ask them to change that message, to switch from red meat to plant-based, because for every cow, we need about 200 chickens to get the same amount of meat, because they're much smaller, right? So if you want the same volume of meat, you need a lot more animals who will suffer a lot more. So bad idea. I don't want you to get hung up on your own consumption and look at with a magnifying glass at ingredients list, etc., and lose time with that, because I think that you only have, well, you do have an important impact with what you eat, but you have a potentially much bigger impact with your influence on how other people eat. So this is your activism, this is your communication, and it's potentially much bigger in terms of impact than the impact of your own consumption. So otherwise said, you save a number of chickens, but if you can influence a couple of people to change their diet, you save many more chickens or other animals, right? So activism, communication, using your voice is, I think, one of the most important things. And you don't have to be the perfect vegan for that. Allow everybody to help animals and allow everybody to talk about meat reduction, animal products reduction. It might be even, you can think that like a non-vegan talking about this is not consistent and will not be believed. Maybe, but maybe it's the opposite. We had this campaign, you may remember, Dagen zonder vlees in Belgium. This was done by a person who is not a vegetarian. And nobody said, like, this is not credible. On the contrary, people were thinking, like, she is somebody, she was a student when she started, Alexia, she's somebody like us. She's not the vegan talking to us from on high, telling us what to do. So that is maybe one of the reasons why this campaign worked so well, right? So don't think it's only the vegans who can talk about helping animals. If you want to talk, if you want to talk about these things, then I think there is something like some ideal position, maybe somewhere in the middle of being too timid. Some people will not want to open their mouths. They say, like, I don't want to create problems. They're not confrontational. They avoid confrontation. And some people love confrontation just a little bit too much, right? And they just are very in their face, and they will call each other murderers, etc. I would say it's somewhere in between, and it might depend on the situation or you have in front of you, but try to be flexible in your approach of how you talk to people, right? Don't be ashamed, don't be embarrassed to stand up for those ideas because they're so important, but also be human, take into account that people may have a hard time weaning themselves off animal products, that they might already feel guilty and that they don't need you to feel even more guilty because then they're going to like back off even further, etc. Also, if you're not maybe not very good in words, you're not a very good talker, a smooth talker or whatever, you can also work with good food, right? Food is one of the best arguments. You don't need any other argument if you have good food. And if you can get people to have a great food experience, then they're going to accept arguments about animals, etc., a lot easier because they're going to realize there's nothing to lose. They know that they can have good food and they can be more open to what you are saying, right? So if you're a good cook, cook for them, otherwise don't do it. Take them to restaurants, shop with them, cook with them, do something. Or if you don't want to do any of this, you're like, you don't like people very much, put your food on your Instagram feed and show how nice the vegan lifestyle can be. Only nice pictures, nothing like this, okay? It's not because you made it that it looks good. It's just like with babies. Okay. You can go further, you can do things like this, like, you know, activism, like with buttons and t-shirts and hats and try to like engage people these ways. You can also join an organization and participate in these actions in Belgium by Bite Back or other organizations. You can especially learn to speak to people, learn to talk to people in a way that is effective and that creates allies. And I think one of the most important skills that you can learn to develop is to put yourselves in their shoes and to try always to see how they would hear your message and how they would see you and how they would judge your behavior. It's very important to try to take their position, their perspective, and see how they might think and might experiencing it. I'm going to skip this. It's also important to know that there are times when it's not the right time to advocate for animals, right? Some people take every single opportunity to say, like, oh, how am I going to make sure this person is more vegan when I leave him than before, you know? There's moments when it's not the best time. For instance, during dinner, it's often not the best time. When people are eating meat, it's often not the best time. I think also a very basic thing for me is just being nice. I don't know who this guy is, but he's in all my presentations. He's my prototype of the nice vegan. So just being nice is a very important thing because people are going to approach vegans already with certain prejudices. Like, this is going to be a person that's going to make me feel guilty. This is going to be a person that's going to be angry at me, etc. So try to not confirm that idea that people have of you. It's very hard because, I mean, when you're a vegan, when you're somebody who tries to do good, you're already at a disadvantage. Have you heard of the term do-gooder derogation? So do-gooder derogation. Derogation is the putting down of someone. So the putting down of the do-gooder. So what's happening here? You do something good and other people will laugh at you. Have you ever experienced that? Like, or maybe you've done it yourself with some people who are even more woke than you or whatever, you know? The thing that happens is when somebody else does something that's perceived as good and you're not doing that, you're not being yourself, you might feel inferior and you might feel bad. Because maybe some part of you knows that you should do like that person. I mean, most people know that the way we treat animals in factory farms is really bad. So people know, okay, they're not doing that, they're not participating in factory farming, but I am, and now I feel bad. And the way that they solve that, the way they deal with that is by punching back, and that by ridiculing this person and by trying to find inconsistencies like, are your shoes vegan and are you still flying and do you still do that or whatever, you know, that's the way people defend themselves. So very hard to deal with that. And I think one of the ways to deal with that is to try to be nice and not to give them an even bigger feeling of guilt. Also important is anger is in a lot of cases going to be not very productive. I can understand anger, I get angry myself, but often it's not going to be productive, it's going to increase the distance between you and them, especially because this do-gooder derogation, because they already feel guilty. Sense of humor is very important, I think. I'm using this picture because I posted it years ago on my Facebook and some vegan was complaining and said like, oh, this reminds me of the lobster in the cooking pot and I hear her cries, etc. And I understand, I empathize, but if we're going to be so serious and so sad, then it's going to be very hard to attract more people to this movement, right? So we have to keep a sense of humor and it's also going to be more sustainable for ourselves. I think that this is a big part of my book. I describe the attitude that we should have at this time as pragmatic, not to be over idealistic. Pragmatic means that we're going to go for results. They may not be ideal results, they may not be the results we want, they may not be the results that people do for the reasons that we want them to have. They might do it for money, they might do it for health, they might do it for whatever reason, but we have to accept anything that creates results for animals or for the planet or for whatever. Also have to accept that people's pace of changing is different. Other people's change is different. This is usually used to explain the adoption of new technology. It's called diffusion of innovation curve. So how are people adopting innovations? So if you don't have a smartphone still today, you are here somewhere. If you had a smartphone already in 1998, you were here. If you're vegan or vegetarian today, you're all here. You're innovators or early adopters. And the great majority is going to come later. And it is with everything, it is like that. Especially with food, a lot of people are very afraid of new food. So they're only going to change, they're only going to join the trend when a lot of other people are doing it. And there's going to be the laggards who are only going to do it when 95% of the people has done it. So accepting that, knowing that is just how it is, maybe helps you to be a little bit more patient. And I think patience is really important because this is not a sprint, this is not a marathon, this is an ultra marathon, right? This is going to take some time still. It's going to happen, but it's going to take some time. We also have to accept that things are not perfect, these alternatives are not perfect, we shouldn't keep complaining about how these things are not healthy or how they're wrapped in plastic or whatever, you know. Progress happens in steps. We have not ideal products, not ideal meat substitutes, but they're going to get better and better and better. Just accept that. Also, another aspect of being pragmatic is that the why people do it is not so important. If people change for environmental reasons, for allergies, for whatever, it's not so important. You know, the reason why all of you who might be vegan have such a wide choice in plant-based milks today, that's not because of the vegans, that's because of the fact that a lot of people these days consume plant-based milks for whatever reason. For allergies, for health reasons, because they like the taste better, because their son is allergic, I don't know what. But for some reason other than the reason you might want them to have. And so because of all these people, the share of plant-based liquid milk in the world is already 14%. It's not all the vegans drinking all that milk, right? It is all kinds of people for all kinds of reasons consuming that milk, creating demand, creating options so that we have an easier time being vegan, right? So appreciate the fact that there's a lot of people who have different reasons and who are not entirely vegan, because their importance is very big. They create demand and they create supply and they create options and they make it easier for everybody. It's also okay for companies to grow. A lot of us are very much on the left, are very much anti-capitalist, and I am so myself, but you also have to realize the important part that companies, big companies especially, may play. So just an example, Vegetarian Butcher, I think you all know the brand, started as a very small shop in Den Haag, right? And at some point, years later, when it was really doing well, when it had built out a brand, was bought by Unilever, right? Unilever, a big evil company, whatever. But this big company had the means to take this product, to take this brand to the next level. If the Vegetarian Butcher had remained very small, it could never have become the supplier of Burger King, right? Burger King is, and the burgers at Burger King are the Vegetarian Butcher burgers, right? And you see the brand here. And Burger King has done a lot of experimentation. They have these pop-up plant-based Burger Kings. They are really trying to change their offerings and trying to make it a lot more plant-based, etc. And Unilever in itself has expanded this product, has exported it to already over 60 countries, and they want to be in all the countries where they are present with this product, which is 192 countries. Do you know how many countries there are in the world? 193. So they're almost everywhere. They can export this product to all over the world. Vegetarian Butcher by itself couldn't do that. And you can still think that they're evil, you can still think that they're in it for the money, but you have to realize that also at these big evil companies, there are good people too. There are people who really want to change. There are vegans there too. There's people who care about sustainability there too. So don't be too cynical about the big companies. This is a booklet that one brand from Unilever, I think it was Unox, gave away to people who were buying a product. Whether it was a vegetarian or a vegan or a meat product didn't matter, but they gave this book to the customers. Anna's Animal World, and Anna was a vegetarian who had a butcher as a father and who was trying to sabotage the butcher and who was saving insects from the water. It's such a very animal-friendly book that people got when they bought a Unilever meat or vegetarian product. A very important thing is that we have to be inclusive. And again, this ties into this idea of not asking for perfection. We want a vegan world, we don't want a vegan club. Sometimes I do have the impression that veganism was invented by two guys who said, like, how can we found the world's smallest club? You know, I see that people have a hard time imagining how they could ever become vegan. It looks so difficult, but then there's some vegan on the other side who says, stop, are you vegan enough? Are you vegan enough to join Team Vegan? Right? I looked for an image of the world's smallest club and I found this Facebook group. It says, this is the world's smallest group. I'm the only fan. If you join it, I will kick you out. This is sometimes how the vegan movement seems to me. Right? We don't want that. We want a very big group, a very inclusive group. A final tip, focus on institutional change. Don't focus so much on trying to change people one by one, but if you have the chance to influence a company, a school, a university, do that. This is your uncle. You can try to change him. You can try to change him and you will have a certain impact if Uncle Bob changes. But this is a person who works in the cafeteria and who's responsible maybe for the quality of the food in a certain cafeteria. It's more interesting to influence this person than Uncle Bob. And this is the woman who is his boss. And maybe she decides about all the restaurants where people like him work. So it's even more interesting to go higher up the chain and influence there. So that's institutional change. Here's one example. This guy is called Andy van den Dobbelsteen, clearly a Dutch guy. He works at the University of Delft. He has calculated the impact, the CO2 emissions of the faculty where he works, Faculty of Construction, of Engineering, And he calculated that food has the biggest impact. And thanks to his research, he was able to convince all the people at that faculty to only offer vegetarian and vegan food at that faculty. That's an example of how one person can, easily or not, implement institutional change. Try to go for that. Try to create the skills that you need for that. The third part is your money. You can have an impact with your money. This is kind of like a semi-sad truth about life. You know, these are three lives. We're young, we're middle-aged, and we're older. And then you can see which resources we have available. When you're young, you have time and energy, but no money. When you're middle-aged, you have no time, but you have money and energy. When you're older, you may have time, you may have money, but you don't have energy anymore, right? So you have to look at these different phases in your life to see how you can contribute. Sometimes it's with money, sometimes it's with time, sometimes it's in another way. And some people at a later stage in life will have some money and they can donate, and that is activism too. If you are in Belgium and you have a household income of 25,000 euros a year, that's the median income in Belgium. Median means half earns more, half earns less than you. This is about 2,000 euros a month. If you are in that situation in Belgium with the one family, you are in the richest 4% of the world's population. And you are 21 times as rich as the global average. The average. You are probably 500 times as rich as the poorest, right? So you have all the reason, and I'm just saying this for to those who it applies, right? Some people cannot give, but at a certain point in your life, you may be able to give something. I'll skip this. Effective altruism, again, gives some guidance to where you can spend your money. It's especially important to give it to causes that are real or organizations that are really effective. And finally, your career. So you can join a non-profit, you can join a for-profit like Alpro. Maybe you have a scientific degree and you can help with developing all kinds of meat replacements, but also other degrees can be interesting. Maybe you have a law degree, or maybe you can do something in your school. Maybe you're somebody working for government and you can create change there. Or maybe you have, or you want to found a startup at some point, right? Maybe you want to found a new company, and then please let it be something useful. Right? There were, in times of COVID, there were thousands of web shops launched every day online, right? And most of those obviously were selling products that we did not need, right? So I'm asking you to really think about what you can contribute in your career, in this life, to make things better for animals especially, and for this planet. This is your life in months. I'm here. Many of you are younger and are somewhere here. So the question is, what are you going to do with that rest of your active life? Are you going to fill it with developing, marketing, selling something that we don't need more of? Like some new razor blade or some new shampoo? Like a solution to a non-existing problem? Or are you going to fill it in with something really meaningful? I like this quote: the secret of life is to have a task, something you devote your entire life to, something you bring everything to every minute of your of the day for the rest of your life. And the most important thing is, it must be something that you cannot possibly do. It must be something bigger than yourself that will not just help animals, it will also create meaning for your lives. Thank you very much.
Je vais parler en français parce que mon anglais est très 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 mauvais, donc on va passer sur un petit moment d'échange et de questions pendant une dizaine de minutes. Soit vous levez la main, vous parlez bien fort, soit on vous passe le micro, du coup pour les plus timides d'entre vous. Voilà, je ne sais pas si vous le sentez, mais allez. Oula.
Hi there, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you very much, first of all, for doing this in English, but I really appreciate it. Okay, please. Just wanted to say, I completely agree with what you said, especially about not focusing on the perfection. But as well, I want to just mention that there is also a very thin line between, you know, promoting things like flexitarianism and things that really don't do that much good to the to animal rights, animal welfare. Because like many people get comfortable as well with the idea of, oh well, I'm doing enough. If I just do this, it's gonna be enough. I'm just not gonna eat meat on Mondays, and that's gonna be enough. And many people get comfortable to that concept and that idea, and they don't want to take a step further. That on one side, and on the other side, I also think that if we just focus on the animals and in the individuals, there's a huge difference as well. If you say, well, I'm just gonna keep on eating cheese, because there's still animals, individuals are still suffering. And if we don't put concepts like the value of an animal as an individual as well, I think we can create the wrong concept. Because it's a justice movement at the end as well. Mm-hmm. We're looking for justice, like the fight against racism or you know, feminism. We cannot say things like it's okay if you're cruel towards women on just 4 times per week, or if you know, which is racist to certain kind of races. You know, like it's. I think it's important to. When we are sending out the message, we can say things like, it's okay what you're doing, it's really good, it makes such a great impact. But we cannot be, we have to be careful with the way we express it, not to say like,
yeah. Okay, thank you. I have slightly different ideas about that, which I expose at length in my book. My idea is to be pragmatic and to do whatever works. And I agree with you that animals have rights, we're anti-speciesist, we can't do this, we can't do that. But very often, that is going to be a message that doesn't arrive with people. This is being what I call idealistic. This is the arguments that we love most, that we care about most, that we think are most worthy. Maybe the animals that changed, the arguments that changed us, but they're not necessarily what's going to change other people. My idea, which I explain also in the book, is that this, what you describe, is exactly where we want to get. But how we start to get there is not so important. So we have to start opening doors to change people's behavior, opening doors to their hearts. And that can be through all kinds of other arguments where we not necessarily need to lead with the arguments about justice, etc., that you are mentioning. And it is very important, I think, to make people take the first step. The first step that can open doors towards better and more and further growth. And that first step can be, we can convince people to take that step by all kinds of different means, by talking about the planet, talking about taste, etc. Not necessarily always by talking about animals. Anyway, this is a long discussion. This is a very big discussion within the movement. If you want to know more about my opinion, watch some of my talks online or check my book. But I agree that this is the end goal. I just disagree or have different ideas about, or I think there are multiple strategies of how to get there. I don't think there's one strategy. Yeah.
I just want to thank you briefly. That's not ping-ponging about anything you said, but on my journey on becoming more and more vegetarian, it was really difficult when I went to encounter people that were really vindictive about their veganism. That would tell me, well, I'm taking vitamin B12 because I don't want to die. You're like, I'm asking you why you're doing it. Maybe you can give me proper reasons to not directly call me an idiot. Mm-hmm. And the fact you mentioned that, if I have to rephrase it in my own way, we have to be careful on the way we communicate. Yeah, that really resonates on me. I just wanted to thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, I think we all have a lot to learn about how to communicate with people, and we all get angry, we all get impatient, we all see these horrible movies online, and after that we just want to shout and we want to scream and we want to say, like, don't you fucking get it, you know? But those other people have not seen the movies often. They are not, they have not had the experiences in their lives that we've had, they haven't had the same influences. We might as well just be like them if we had had their experiences, right? So we have to be a bit compassionate in terms of how we approach them. And I think that the art is to find a balance between being patient and being asking enough. It's like a bit like you say, I mean, it is possible to give the people a sense of like, yeah, a sense of like, I'm doing enough or whatever, but we also have to make sure that we don't like try to make them go too fast and then they turn off, right? So some kind of balance between those two attitudes, and that may differ from person to person.
Yeah. I also think regarding this question that today we cannot ask so much because we are so small. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe in like 30 years, or I don't know, if we are a bigger group, then we can ask what he wants to ask now. I think the problem is he compares it to like racism and feminism, but they are in our society mostly accepted norms. And I think there is just a big difference between an accepted norm that you can be very hard in the way you talk to people and a norm that is really chaotic.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think we can all experiment with different ways to approach people, and I'm fully supportive of the way that you approach people. I would just not say to each other like, you're doing it the wrong way. That said, I do think that if you want to compare, for instance, sexism or rape or child abuse with meat eating, I don't think that's a good parallel at all, because meat eating is something that 95% of us celebrates, you know, and child abuse is something that 99% of us condemns. So they're, like you say, it's different norms. You cannot communicate about them with the same strategies and in the same way, I think, even though in theory you might be right. But the question is not, are you right? The question is, do you help animals? The question is, do you have actual impact? Yeah. Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. I heard a lot about our demands, and now we can change behavior, and now we can change other people's behavior. Maybe I'm a bit missing is about the supply and about the governance of the shift towards a plant-based system. And I feel that this is part also the reason. I'm a climate activist as well myself, and I feel that this also kind of reflected there, and a lot of times there are even corporations that are actually trying to blame and point the fingers towards individuals who are shifting away the attention from the political debate that we need to have, the regulation that we need to change, the subsidies that we need to shift.
Yeah.
And I think that it's also very important in this extent that we consider that we need to also shift the farmers themselves. And so I feel like it's our power as individuals, not just as consumer, but mostly as citizens that have political will. And so I feel like, yeah, I just wanted to hear from you. What do you think, and why didn't you think that this is like big part of it?
Yeah, I mean, it is. You're absolutely right. It is under what I call institutional change. We have to get not just trying to influence companies, etc., but definitely also lawmakers, politicians, etc. We have to get more political as a movement. Definitely, I have other stuff about that, other separate talk about that. I mean, this was a talk more about like what we all can do, and obviously we can all vote in certain direction, but yeah, I mean, I think that's very obvious. But if there's people who have the chance to be able to get more political and to influence on that level, that is, I think, one of the very best things that we can do at this moment. And you're right, the change has to come from above. We probably will not be able to make it without the support of governments, politicians, influencers on that level. It's going to be a long game. It's not easy, you know, but slowly but surely they are starting to get it. So yeah, by all means, I think it's very important. I think we should get into it. I think we should do a lot more about this thing, about political change, definitely. Yeah.
Donc pour la suite, nous aurons la chance d'avoir Victoria Ostrad qui viendra présenter un petit peu l'animalisme politique et qui fera un état du droit animalier en région wallonne. Merci encore.